In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, one God. My dear ones, I greet you today with the blessings of a new year. Of course, we expect this on January 1st, but also on September 1st. September 1st is the beginning of the ecclesiastical new year. I mentioned last night, this is why our books on chanting, when you look at the chant books of the church, they always begin with the month of September and then go through August. And this is because at the first ecumenical synod in 325, September 1st was officially established as the beginning of the ecclesiastical year, because this is when all of the crops were gathered. And so with the new season of crops, because so many people's lives revolved around their own crops, the ecclesiastical year began at this point as well. We gather up what we completed the year with and we begin anew. And we have in today's new beginning this beautiful gospel of Christ at a young age teaching in a synagogue. And in reading this passage from the book of Isaiah, he defines his own ministry before it truly begins. He uses this prophetic voice of Isaiah to describe what his ministry is going to really be about. And what he says is that his ministry, more than anything, is about freedom. It's about true freedom. He comes to release the captives and to set at liberty those who are oppressed. So a lot of times we look at the Orthodox Church and we think, well, the Orthodox Church itself feels like oppression. It doesn't feel like freedom. Because there are all these rules. There are rules for what to do and how to act within the liturgy. There are rules for what services to come to. There are rules for when to fast and how to fast. There are rules for how to pray. We put ourselves in obedience to a spiritual father who we confess to. It seems like it can be all about rules. Rules, rules, rules. And it feels like servitude. But the reality is that we cannot escape servitude of some sort. We want the proper servitude. We want proper slavery. We want slavery to God. Slavery to God grants us abundant good things such that God does not even want us to be his slaves anymore. You begin as slaves and end as children and as friends of God. So close that he wants to share everything he is with us. This is the dictum of the fathers. All that God is by nature, we will become by grace. He wants to, in full humility, give himself to us. If we don't have the initial slavery that leads to that freedom, then we aren't going to find another freedom. There is no other freedom. It's one slavery or another. It's slavery to God or slavery to the demons and our passions. Father Justin likes to give this example a lot. For many men, can you walk down the street and not look at the beautiful women? Can you go your whole day without being lazy? Can you be offended by somebody? Can they spread rumors about you and insult you to your face and you not get angry with them? Not have bitterness? The reality is most of us can't. We're already slaves. We think we're free, but we're not. We're already slaves. And we give ourselves over to this slavery every single time we sin. Whenever we sin, every single day, we give ourselves over again and again and again. So we run back to Christ and realize that all the things that the church gives us, the prayer, the fasting, the liturgy, all these rules are not really rules at all. They're medicines. They're medicines that teach us not to be slaves to our passions and not to rely on our own fallen wills, but rather to be transfigured in Christ so we can have true freedom. You see this in the scriptures themselves. The scriptures say, both St. Paul and St. Peter have very, very similar lines in which they say, live as free men, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as slaves of God. When we read the scriptures without reading them prayerfully and slowly, we go past that line and without even realizing the paradox. Listen to the beginning of the verse. Live as free men. And what's the end of that verse? Live as slaves of God. Freedom for us is slavery to God. That's where we find true freedom. Live as free men, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Because in that case, it's not true freedom. It's slavery to the demons. Rather, live as slaves of God. That's true freedom. I knew a priest who had had a dream. I know a lot of priests who had pretty special calls to the priesthood. And some of them witnessed pretty incredible miracles. But not everyone does. Not everyone has that direct calling. But I had one friend in particular who said that while he didn't feel a particular, he didn't experience a particular miracle calling him to the ministry, he did have a dream before he was ordained. So before he actually became a priest, he had a dream that really stuck with him. In the dream, he ended up right at the entrance of someone's home. And he looked down and he saw that he was vested completely in white, as if it were Pascha. He had the full priest vestments on, complete white, brilliant white. But he knew that he wasn't there for a good reason. And there was a long hallway, and it's just like any other family's hallway with lots of pictures all over the place. And a woman was leading him down the hallway, and he knew what he was going to. He was going to perform an exorcism. And as he turned the corner, there was a large room, and all the family members gathered around a young girl. And the young girl was clearly possessed. And this young girl simply looked at him, and he immediately woke up. He said he's never felt such an evil presence in his life. There was something so real about that gaze. But when he woke up with words that he didn't hear, but they were embedded deeply in his heart. And the words were, "Do not let them have any rights over you. Don't let them have any rights over you." He understood the message of this dream to be, we're going to let either God have rights over us or the demons. We're going to give our rights to someone. No matter what, one side or the other is going to have a rule over us. And that rule depends on our own choice. We're going to give one side or the other mastery over our souls. We can be slaves to the demons, or we can be slaves to Christ. Being slaves to the demons is easy. It's extremely easy to be a slave of your own passions. It's extremely easy to give in to every whim of your soul and every whim of your body. To eat when you're hungry, whatever you want. To drink when you're thirsty. To sleep when you're tired. To fulfill lustful thoughts. To be lazy. To be angry. To do all these things. It doesn't take any great work on our behalf. That's easy. And it's uninspiring. And it ends up that the more we give into those things, the more extremely we need to give into them later to fulfill our desires. And this is where addictions come from. Slavery to Christ is true freedom because it frees us from these things. We can live truly free there. St. John Chrysostom has an entire treatise entitled, "Nobody Can Harm the Man Who Does Not Harm Himself." Nobody can harm the man who does not harm himself. If we're going to be harmed by the demons and our passions, it's because we are going to assent to them. We're going to give them rights over ourselves. If we're going to be harmed, it's going to be us. I'll tell you that within this slavery, there's a terrible temptation that exists today that we see all around us. And it's the temptation to take on a victimhood mentality. To almost bask and glorify in being victims. The mentality is really based on a Marxist worldview, okay? So the Marxist worldview has a lens through which it views everything. And that lens is a lens of power. There are those who are the oppressors, and there are those who are the oppressed. And in viewing the world this way, we don't want to be accused of being an oppressor, so we glorify ourselves in being one of the oppressed. We actually get excited about being oppressed. In this mentality, the more oppressed you are, the louder your voice can be, and the more moral backing your voice has. You recognize this, I suspect. You see this around us all the time. But of course, this throws away the entire concept of truth. Truth becomes subjective. The more of a victim you are, the more true what you say is. Of course that doesn't work. Truth is above this. Truth transcends this. It transcends our personal experiences. But the reality is that this victim mentality also has very dangerous spiritual ramifications. And as Christians, I tell you right now, we are prone to the same mentality. Don't think that you're free from this. We take it on whenever we react to people as individuals or to society going against us. So in other words, there's two ways that we take on this victimhood mentality. We take it on more generally as members of society, as a greater society, or personally when we are personally attacked or slandered. So why is this so dangerous? Why do we need to avoid this victimhood mentality? I'm going to give you just a few reasons for why. Number one, the goal of embracing a victimhood mentality is to change those around us. But notice the real results. It's not to change us, it's to change everybody around us. I'm a victim, therefore you need to change, you need to understand my pain, you need to understand what I'm going through and change the way you're living. But what are we really doing? It shows us that it's the world affecting us. The fact that we feel like we're victims in the first place and we use that to define ourselves means the world has already affected us. We're not affecting the world. And what happens as we go along with this mentality? The more we feel a victim, the more bitter we become, the more resentful, the more depressed, the more anxious, the more angry. No one can harm the man who does not harm himself. We really harm ourselves in this. We end up more bitter. We end up more bruised. And that makes us less effective in changing the world around us. Discord increases, and unity and peace, joy, thanksgiving, they all die in the process. It's not transformative for the world. It's transformative for us, but in a very negative way. Secondly, victimhood sees this world as our true homeland. We as Christians know that's not true. Is it true that Christians, especially today, are disregarded, slandered, and hated? Is it true that Christians have been slaughtered more in the 20th and 21st century than any other time in history? Yes. Of course those things are true. But this isn't our true homeland. We don't get focused on that. We don't get wrapped up in that. We don't become angry and bitter about that because this isn't our true homeland. Christ told us it was going to happen. This isn't a surprise. He said, if they hate me, they'll hate you also. We should expect that this is the way the world is going to go. The only way out of this is either to try to annihilate the world completely, and that's not going to happen, or try to mix the world with Christ like mixing oil with water. Okay, so take what I mean by this is take the subject of TV. Okay, the official studies say that about 2-3% of the population identifies as homosexual, and yet when you watch TV, is it just 2-3% of characters or 2-3% of television shows that have a character who promotes homosexuality and the LGBT ideals? Of course not. It's way more than that. And yet, there's a much higher percentage. About 70% of Americans continue to identify themselves as Christian. Do we see a proportional rate on TV of characters who are Christian? Are 70% of characters and do 70% of shows have Christian characters? Of course not. Of course not. And when they do, how are they portrayed? As hypocritical bigots, as jerks, as people you wouldn't want anything to do with. So, is it true that there's a negative portrayal of Christianity? Absolutely. But what do we want to do about that? We can try our best to influence Hollywood so that they show an LGBT character and a Christian living side by side where there's no clash of culture at all and everyone's happy together and there's no fault because there's no sin and there's no sin and there's no unhappiness and everyone's happy together. And of course, that destroys Christianity itself. Or we can try to put Christians more prevalently in a positive light on television movies so that we have more of an excuse to spend our time watching television and movies. There's no win here. There's no win. No matter what, we end up losing because we're going to be fed garbage no matter what, even if that garbage has a nice flavor to it at first. Maybe we should see this as an opportunity. This is not our true homeland. This is not our true homeland. Instead of creating a social movement based on victimhood, trying to get Netflix and Disney and Hulu to change their programming, why not just use this as an opportunity to get rid of our addiction to laziness and TV? Get rid of your subscriptions to Netflix. There's no use in them. Netflix produces shows that are patently anti-Christian. We're actually paying them money through our subscriptions to fight us. We're paying them money to corrupt our children. We're paying them money to make our life as Christians harder. It doesn't make any sense. This isn't our true homeland. So get rid of these things. Cancel your subscriptions to satellite TV. Focus more on a spiritual life. Instead of focusing on victimhood, look at this as an opportunity. The victimhood mentality shows an unhealthy love for this world. And in it, we forget our true homeland, which is the next life. And finally, third, the victimhood mentality forgoes an obvious crown in being persecuted and embraces instead spiritual damage. I can point out the sickness of our popular culture and television, but there's no point in starting a movement to transform TV, because what I really want to transform is myself. The victimhood mentality is self-focused rather than Christ-focused. It seeks to make sure that the world sees that we're victims as we whine and we complain. But we miss out on the opportunity to grow in humility, to become more Christ-like, and to seek Christ more fully. In other words, it increases our pride. We begin to think that where the fathers taught us to glorify God in our suffering and rejoice in being persecuted in Christ, we sit there and say, well, the fathers didn't really understand me. My suffering is so much worse. What I go through is so much more horrible. They have no idea how bad my life was. The fathers can't tell me to glorify God in my suffering, because look at me, look how terrible this is. Everyone paid attention to me. How good is that for us? The reality is when we make those claims, by the way, we have no idea what we're talking about. The fathers endured far more suffering than we're going through right now, or likely than we ever will. Even though things will get worse for us, we know where this is headed. We know where the world is going. This will get worse for us. But the point is, do not focus on self-pity in this. Don't focus on victimhood. Rather, seek God more fully. We're not going to come up with better solutions than the fathers, or better solutions than Christ. We're not going to be more compassionate than them. We're not going to be more effective or more loving or more helping than them. We're not going to find some better way to transform the world than they did. We need to follow in their path, and their path is holiness. That's what transforms the world. As we celebrate the beginning of the ecclesiastical new year, we also celebrate the life of Saint Simeon the Stylite. He was the first of these saints known as Stylites. A Stylite was one of these fathers who would go and they'd build a pillar. And they would live on top of that pillar for years. We think, well, isn't this prideful? They're drawing attention to themselves, but no. What they're actually doing is depriving themselves of every human comfort such that they can't even leave the small platform on which they've built themselves. Saint Simeon was the first to do this. He excelled in asceticism. At one point, he neither ate nor drank for the entire 40 days of Lent. And from then on after, he continued to do so. His asceticism was so great that he was actually driven out of a monastery. The abbot said, all the other monks, they can't even get close to you, so you either have to temper your asceticism or leave. And he said, okay, I'll leave. So he left, and then God revealed to the abbot what a mistake that was, and so the abbot went and brought him back to the monastery, but he didn't stay long. He went back into the wilderness and built this pillar, about 7.5 feet tall, not huge, and he began this ascetic struggle. But as people began flocking to him, with his days being passed, standing and kneeling in prayer and fasting constantly, without end, he decided he needed to get a little bit further away, and so he would build it up and up and up and up and up. It was something like 60 feet high by the end of his life, with walls built around it to keep the crowds from rushing in towards him. He would work miracles from up there, but he would afflict his flesh and the passions in every single way until he was perfected. He lived a life of such extreme asceticism. He lived to over the age of 100. 80 of those years were lived in asceticism, and 47 of those years were lived on top of this pillar. 47 years. No traveling. We also commemorate his mother. He refused to see his mother. His mother was looking for him all over the world. She finally found out where he was and went to see him. And he called out from the top of the pillar without looking down, "We can see each other in the next life. Focus instead on prayer and fasting this life." So she said, okay, and she stood at the bottom of the pillar and lived out the rest of her life in prayer and fasting until she reposed. St. Martha, we commemorate her today as well. But here's the significant thing. St. Simeon lived just a few years after Christianity was legalized for the first time by the Emperor Constantine. Before that, the Christians went through numerous periods of intense persecution. And St. Simeon's response was the same as many of the ascetics. If they are no longer going to persecute me, I'm going to persecute myself. I'm not going to wallow in victimhood. We need to be driven out from love of this world and love of our own passions. We need things to afflict us. We need to be victims, and not to bask in being a victim, as if that gives us a greater voice, but rather so that we can turn inward, so that we can see the passions within us and actually conquer them. St. Simeon would have been fine being persecuted by heretics, by the pagans, by the atheists, but because he couldn't, he chose to live 47 years atop a pillar and persecute himself. There is nothing, forgive me, I'm going to be bold about this, but there is nothing transformative or inspiring about whiny bitterness and complaints. It neither helps us, nor it helps anybody outside of us. It doesn't transform the world one bit, except to bring more bitterness in the world. Christians rejoice in their suffering, especially when it is unjust. It doesn't mean we don't fight for justice, because we want to see souls saved. But when that injustice hits us, we glorify God in it. To transform this world, we have to bring heaven down. And where does heaven descend? Into a pure heart. Not into ideologies, not into political movements, and not into personal bitterness when we feel we've been attacked. Heaven descends into a pure heart. And a pure heart transforms the world. Become holy, in other words. You want to transform the world, you want to save yourself from bitterness, become a holy father, become a holy mother, become a holy spouse, become a holy worker, become a holy child, become holy in whatever situation you're in. The opportunity and the crown is there for your grasping. The victimhood mentality rejects the crown and throws it aside, tosses it into the garbage heap. The victim mentality increases bitterness in the world. It increases bitterness in our souls, and because it rejects the joy of the gospel, it is anti-Christian, period. The Christian life is defined by gratitude and thanksgiving, by joy and peace, and by love of neighbor, especially of the neighbors who hate us and persecute us. We may not be there yet. Of course, we're not there yet. But we beg God for the grace to get there. St. Siloam the Athenite says, "The true sign that grace is within you is if you truly love and weep for your enemies. But if you continue to hate your enemies, it's not grace that's within you, it's a demon." That's a tough word to hear. But rather than let this beat us down and become victims by this, let this inspire you towards something greater. We have a new beginning today. This is the beginning of the new ecclesiastical year. Use this year to strive forward. Embrace the joy of the Christian life, and if you're beaten and persecuted along the way, because you will be, and like I said, it will only get worse in this world, glorify God that we're being reminded we are not members of this homeland. This is not our world. This is not our homeland. The next life is. And Christ wants to bring that world with power to us. That power doesn't come with bitterness and anger. It doesn't come with whining. It comes with thanksgiving. It comes with joy, and it comes with great ascetic effort. May we live holy lives and start this year right. Amen.